You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Caden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Caden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. FRKNA coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza, sanctions placed on two extremist Israeli politicians, and the MBR rich list. For International Desk, I spoke to Andre Fawso about the protest against ICE in Los Angeles, and I spoke to the National Business Review's Mike McRoberts about their recently published rich list. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
For this week's City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson about this week's release of falling housing valuations along with rising rates and the progress on key Auckland City Rail link stations. As well, I spoke to University of Auckland Associate Professor Scott Opdekin about Trump's use of force against the LA anti-ICE protesters.
Hea ha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e ware ware I ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero ano, he pakehere rukiruki mārunga I te pae tukutuku o irirangi pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM, ira Cathy Com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
New Zealand and key allies have imposed sanctions on two extremist Israeli politicians for their role in inciting violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. Foreign Affairs Minister Winston Peters says the pair have used their political positions to advocate for the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements into Palestinian territory. However, opposition parties, including Labour, as well as the Greens and Te Pāti Māori, are calling for further action to be taken against Israel. It comes after Israel kidnapped 12 pro-Palestine activists on international waters who were intending to break the aid blockade and reach Gaza. Several of these activists, including European Parliament member Rima Hassan, are still detained in Israel. And earlier this week, the National Business Review released their annual rich list. It found that the most wealthy in Aotearoa are now collectively worth over $100 billion. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about these topics. Were you supportive of the Freedom Flotilla's mission to bring aid to Gaza?
We're all looking at that situation and seeing the absolute horrific humanitarian crisis unfold before our eyes. And so there has to be support for getting aid in there.
Should there be diplomatic pressure put on Israel to release the remaining Madeleine crew members?
Well, certainly we think that that is where we should be heading. And what we have been relieved about recently with regards to the whole situation there is that finally the government, even though it is far too slow, has announced sanctions against two very extreme right-wing ministers from Israel. We think that the government should have acted sooner, and we think that there is far more that needs to be done.
The sanctions that have been placed on these politicians are for their role against Palestinians in the West Bank, but should sanctions also be placed on Israeli politicians for their actions in Gaza?
Well, we think that they need to explore more sanctions. What exactly they are is something to be discussed. But we've been calling for stronger sanctions going back right to the beginning of the term of this government. And they have been very slow to respond. I think that it is time for them to step it up, and they should be exploring all other options with regards to sanctions.
Does Labor call for government MPs to support Chloe Swarbrick's Israeli sanctions bill?
We support the bill, and certainly would be calling on others to support it.
And if returned to power next election, can we expect Labor to have a stronger stance on Israel?
Well, Labor has always had a strong independent foreign policy. We have been very vocal on this issue, and you can expect us to be much more courageous with regards to applying sanctions and other actions that need to be taken for the sake of those that are being harmed and killed on a daily basis.
Will Labor recognise a Palestinian state?
We are still supporters of the two-state, and we will continue to be so.
Does the MBR rich list signal a widening wealth gap in Aotearoa?
Oh, well, certainly. What we see there is that there are so many New Zealanders that are struggling with the rising costs. And at the same time, now the wealthiest are doing better than ever under National. That tells us that something is out of balance.
Is the Kiwi billionaire wealth reaching those who are struggling in the cost of living crisis?
It's certainly not. And the government have made choices that have seen some of those who are the most well off even better off, and seen struggling New Zealanders struggling even more so. We've seen the cutting of women's pay to help fund tobacco, gas and big tech companies. You know, New Zealand needs a government focused on providing well-paying jobs, good healthcare and affordable homes, and should be focused on the cost of living challenges that everyday New Zealanders are facing. But instead, what we've seen are things like tax breaks for landlords, which no one voted for at the last election.
Should this reignite discussions of a wealth tax?
Well, as we've said consistently, there do need to be changes to our tax system. What the answer is there is not something that we have been definitive about at this stage, but you can expect us to speak more about tax in the lead up to the next election.
The Prime Minister says we should be inspired by those on the rich list. Do you agree with this?
I think Prime Minister is completely out of touch. I mean, this is a man who has also stood up in front of cameras and talked about how he's well off and he's sorted and he acknowledges that. Well, you know, that doesn't provide any reprieve for the New Zealanders who struggle on a daily basis to put food on the table and to pay for the accommodation that them and their families are living in. No one begrudges those who have worked hard and have managed to create a secure future for themselves and their families. But at the same time, come on, you know, we want to see all New Zealanders doing well, not just a handful of New Zealanders whilst everyone else struggles to be able to feed their families.
You've mentioned some of these already, but what are the kind of policies that could allow all New Zealanders to do well?
Well, we have to have a focus on job creation and job retention. This government hasn't been focused on that at all. And if you look at the unemployment rate at the moment, which is now across the country at, I think, 5.2%. In Auckland, it's even worse. It's at around 6.4%. There's a lot of New Zealanders that are struggling to even retain work or get into work. What we need to be doing is making sure that we're focused on jobs for New Zealanders, making sure that the terms and conditions of their employment are good so that they can thrive as individuals and families rather than just merely survive to get by on a daily basis. Also, you know, the reality is the housing and health continue to be two of the greatest pressures that families across Aotearoa face. And so there has to be investment and a focus there.
That was Labor Deputy Leader Carmel Sepuloni on the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza, sanctions against Israeli politicians and the MBR rich list.
That was our weekly chat with the Labor Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
On Tuesday, Aucklanders checked the updated property valuations of their houses, for many to find declines in values by tens of thousands of dollars, on average by 9% from when they were last done in 2021. According to the council, rating valuations were based on market trends and recent sales activities as of May 1st, 2024. Wayne Brown said in response to the decreased values, the economy's been faltering for a while and it's really driven by government policies rather than Auckland policies. Also, as we get closer to 2026 and the completion of the City Rail Link, Aucklanders have expressed various concerns about the standard of completion, including incorporation of public feedback. I discuss the incorporation of the wider neighbourhood in Mount Eden at the Mount Ngafo station and the dismissal of public perspectives at the K Road station. My first questions of the interview with Shane Henderson relate to housing valuations. So I wanted to talk first about the property valuations that came out this week. A lot of people have seen a decline in value by tens of thousands of dollars. Can you talk a bit about some of the factors that influence or determine housing values in Auckland and across New Zealand?
So with the revaluation, over a set period of time, we've got to keep looking at the property values to then kind of assess the share of rates that people pay. So 2021 was the last time we did it. That was the absolute top of the market. And I know that very well because that was when I bought my house. And so I can see the decline in property values in real time. But yeah, across the city, you know, there's been decline across most local board areas. And, you know, people are going to pay, you know, the rates rise generally. That's the average rise across the city. But if your property values have gone lower than the average of the city, then you pay lower rates than you would have otherwise done. So that's a very complicated beast, but that's kind of the long and short of it.
Yeah, you've kind of said here, I just wanted to know, like, how are these valuations then used to determine or inform the 5.8% average rate increase as set by council?
Yeah, huge task across the city of individually assessing people's, you know, value of their homes. And that should go out, I think, on Friday. So So tomorrow at this time, people should be not knowing what they're doing from there to get their results, because it's like 680,000 houses. So it's taken months for them to do. But at the same time, look, if you get your valuation and you think it's too low or too high, then there are processes to change it. So jump on 301-0101, that's 301-0101, and yeah, give them a call and let them know your situation and they'll help you out. Like I said, they've had a huge task in front of them doing the houses of every place in the city. So so you just got to check that out and make sure that it sounds about right. And if you do want to challenge it, then give us a call. There's a process to go through. So yeah, just do that.
All right, no problem. I'll move on to my next topic. I wanted to talk a little bit about, so we're halfway through 2025 and inching closer to the completion of the City Rail Link. But we've seen some issues arising around the progress. I'll take the examples here of the Mount Eden station, the Mount Ngafo station and the K Road station.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on the urgent changes Mayor Wayne Brown is seeking in relation to the design of the Mount Ngafo station?
Yeah, look, I'm still seeking advice to get across the detail of it. I can kind of say on the broad brush element of this is that the CRL is an absolute game changer for the city. It's a multi-billion dollar investment that is supposed to be city shaping. So we've kind of got to get it right when we're looking at the station environments and things like things like how do people access it and how do we beautify that area. So those things are all got to be right. So I think it's natural that the mayor and others will be questioning this or that entrance to a station. We've just got to make sure that we're doing good urban design and something that's attractive for people to use.
Now, I understand that they have been a bit hesitant on giving exact dates on opening or the completion time for the City Rail Link. They don't want to get people's hopes up and then have some delays come up. But do you have any concerns about the absence of specific dates at or time frames at this stage of the City Rail Link timeline beyond just 2026?
Yeah, I don't have concerns at the moment around timelines. I mean, maybe one issue might be, look, we've got to plan the city around the CRL, and so we're having these huge discussions around housing enabling and our stations and things like that. That's kind of got to work in parallel with the CRL, and, you know, when it opens, that will be a factor for these kind of discussions. But I don't know, man. We're all really excited to take our first maiden voyage as an entire city, so I'd just love to get that information so that we can plan it and we can enjoy it, yeah.
At a recent meeting, the Uptown Business Association precinct leader was talking about how they were concerned that there wasn't much integration of the broader neighbourhood into the new station at Mount Eden. Could you talk about, if you know at all, how surrounding businesses and spaces in the neighbourhood have been incorporated or involved in decision-making around the development or in the design of the train station in Mount Ngafo?
Yeah, in terms of Mount Ngafo, look, I, with the greatest of respect, because we do need to listen to our stakeholders and this kind of stuff, but look, I point out, you get off the train at Mount Ngafo Station, you're going to have easy access to shopping and hospitality around Upper Simon Street, around Mount Eaton Road, New North Road, Normanby Road, all these kind of places. It's a fantastic part of town, and there will be great access. Obviously, we want to make it as good as possible for people. And, you know, my personal encouragement is that we look at particularly how's that walk-up catchment going. You know, people are going to be using our public transport system more and more, and that's fantastic. When you get out of Mungathoe Station, are you going to be able to walk around easily and safely, maybe transferring to cycling or scooters and things like that as well? It's all these things to think about. I think there's good access there to a lot of great shops and a lot of great hospitality there. So, you know, that's my opinion anyway.
Also talking about the K Road station now, despite this public consultation process producing two-thirds support for particular plans around the K Road station that consider the balance between traffic and pedestrians, why have Auckland Transport proposed different layouts for the design?
Yeah, again, I'd encourage AT to put some real thinking into that because, mate, as I said, around Mungathoe, you need to get off at that station and enjoy the city on foot. And to enjoy things safely and easily, transferring to other transport modes and things like that as well, that's all part of it. But look, we've got to be designing things with these kind of transfers in mind. You know, for example, in my patch in Te Aratu, the bus interchanges there, Lincoln Road bus interchange, there's no parking there. People get on and transfer to other buses and other things like that, and it works fantastically. So, you know, we're still waiting for advice on the details. I just encourage AT to look at all mode users and have a look at that.
What do you think is an appropriate response to public concerns as voiced in the open letter to Auckland Transport, which state that public perspectives were ignored, such as for a pedestrian mall on Upper Mercury Lane, removal of car parking, like you said, protection of the cycleway and more green spaces in the design as well?
Yeah, speaking personally, I think that we need to be listening to the public on this, right? They've made very clear what they think about all these factors. And it's not just the practicality of it in terms of walking around, but as you pointed out, the beautification around things like green spaces. These things we need to be seriously looking at and enacting the will of the people is my personal view.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on housing valuations and the recent discourse surrounding the City Rail link relating to the Mungathoe and K Road stations.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B and text in your thoughts 5395.
The Auckland Philharmonia is doing another performance of that famous guy's music.
Who?
You know that guy? Ba 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 ba.
Oh, he looks kind of grumpy in that painting.
Beethoven!
The Auckland Philharmonia plays Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony at the Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, June 25th at 6:30. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
Challenge your senses in complete darkness with Darkfield, Seance and Flight in Altair Square now. Step inside two custom-built shipping containers and be transported as a strange new world unfolds around you with 360-degree audio and sensory effects that will leave you questioning reality. Darkfield, Seance and Flight. On until June 15 in Aotea Square. For tickets and more info, head to aucklandlive.co.nz.
95 BFM presents the Saints 73-78, making their New Zealand debut at the Power Station Friday, October 31. Get ready to have your senses pummeled by punk pioneers Ed Cooper, Ivor Hay, Mick Harvey, Mark Arm, and Peter Oxley. A once-in-a-lifetime gig. It's the Saints 73-78 live at the Power Station Friday, October 31. Tickets available now from plusone.co.nz.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morena, Mr. Sloth, Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show, bringing stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago. The 95 BFM Kids Show with Finn, 7 to 9 every Sunday morning on BFM.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost. The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10 a.m. Right here on 95BFM.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk are go.
Los Angeles is approaching a week of protests against ICE, the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. ICE raids and deportations have stepped up under the Trump administration after he promised a crackdown on immigration. There are nearly a million undocumented immigrants in Los Angeles, and the city has historically served as a hub of immigrant rights activists. Over 200 protesters have been arrested since the protests began last week, and restrictions have been placed on protesters, including a curfew. The White House has sent 2,000 members of the National Guard to the city already, and another 2,000 are expected to be deployed. This is despite California Governor Gavin Newsom attempting to block their deployment. For International Desk, I spoke to Andre Fausso from the Yale Daily News about the protests. I started by asking why people are protesting.
So the protests that are happening in Los Angeles at the moment have stemmed from Trump's agenda around immigration and around immigration raids. The initial protests which have been happening in Los Angeles this week started with an Immigration, Customs and Enforcement, or ICE, raid, which took place at a Home Depot department store in Los Angeles last week. It became the epicenter of protests and opposition as a strong result because of the scale of that operation. What basically happened was that ICE agents rushed into a Home Depot store, which was known to have predominantly Latin American and mainly Mexican workers in that area and in that store, and then, you know, basically arrested people non-discriminately. And as a result, Los Angeles locals, but then also the immigrant community, came out in strong opposition for the operation itself, but also the deliverance of Trump's mandate to Immigration, Customs and Enforcement of just going and arresting, and in many cases very inhumanely targeting minority communities in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is the hub of Latin American and predominantly Mexican communities in the United States. And so many have accused this crackdown or these operations as an easy target of vulnerable people in this region. Obviously, after that, the protests escalated quite dramatically as Donald Trump responded to some of the initial backlash from locals. And then obviously we see the images we've seen in recent days of the mobilization of the National Guard, and also later discussions of troops being mobilized in the state, and what that's meant for the escalation of tensions, but then also the ongoing protests in the city.
How has the Trump administration's crackdown on protesters inflamed the situation?
Well, that's been one area where Trump has been very heavily criticized, especially from people on the left. Obviously, California is a very liberal state. It's a liberal stronghold for the Democratic Party. And when you look at the city of Los Angeles as well, it's prided itself up until now on being a sanctuary city for immigrant communities, especially the ones that are being targeted by Trump's immigration orders. And so he's been accused of by leaders in California, but then also people around the world and throughout the United States about the inflamed tensions as a result of his responses. People have said that Trump has deliberately provoked protesters as a result of mobilizing the National Guard. He mobilized 2,000 California National Guard troops, something that California Governor Gavin Newsom heavily criticized, but then also pointed out that it's very unprecedented for a president to mobilize state National Guard members to local protests, and it's a level of passing state sovereignty, and that's been a big discussion within the broader debate and discussion around Trump's use of his power and level of overreach in the protests.
How has California Governor Gavin Newsom responded to these protests?
Yeah, so as I said, Governor Gavin Newsom has heavily criticised Donald Trump's actions in terms of his mobilisation and use of government resources, both in the state of California and then also at his presidential disposal. Newsom and Trump have gotten into a very public row over the LA protests. You know, they've both told each other that they're incompetent. Trump has even said that he wants Gavin Newsom to be arrested for his inaction and also his pushback against Trump's actions. The deployments of the National Guard and also later of the Marines in Los Angeles, which is something that Trump recently announced yesterday, will cost upwards of $134 million. That's around 170 million New Zealand dollars. And so there's very intense scrutiny of the amount of resources which are going into cracking down on these protests, but then also obviously what it means for freedom of speech, the right to assemble, and also the safety of immigrant communities in cities such as Los Angeles, where they're very, very prominent. Newsom has said that he hopes that immigrant communities remain safe and protected in the city, and also other politicians in the state of California have reinforced that. But where we see a convergence somewhat is around rioters versus protesters against the cause. We've seen instances where people inevitably have taken advantage of the escalated tensions to try and instigate violence and also destruction of property. And that's where that's been an area where I'd say the perspectives of Trump and Newsom have somewhat converged, and that's been on ensuring that the police and also perhaps even the National Guard and the Marines work to try and quash any levels of violence and obviously destruction to things such as property as well.
This is despite Gavin Newsom being against Trump bringing the National Guard in though, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. Like, because from Newsom's perspective, he believes that it should be on his call of whether the National Guard should be mobilised. And in terms of historical precedent, that's always been the case. The president has always supported or reinforced the calls of local governors in terms of the need for resources, in terms of controlling public disorder. And, you know, historically, I mean, LA has not been a stranger to protests. If you look at, even back to 2020 during George Floyd, and then also in 1992, during the Rodney King riots, that was a period when the California governor mobilized the National Guard rather than the president of the United States. And so it's a level of precedent, but also of a question of state sovereignty as well. And maybe that's not a discussion which, you know, countries like such as Aotearoa New Zealand can be familiarized or be understanding of, but that's been one big debate that's being had in the US at the moment.
Has there been much international backlash to the police crackdowns, particularly from Australia, after an Australian journalist was shot by police with a rubber bullet?
Well, obviously, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese spoke out about the Nine News journalist that got shot with a rubber bullet. You know, obviously, it was precedent setting for the fact that it was an international journalist, but also the fact that it was live on air when that whole incident happened. Prime Minister Albanese expressed a shock and disgust for that incident, and obviously for the violence that it reflected, the increased tensions. But also that Nine News journalist that got hit by a rubber bullet had also experienced, you know, harassment from some of the protesters that were, you know, protesting along the sidelines. And so, you know, it was more just a broader reflection of escalated tensions on both sides, on, you know, both the sides of the police and also the National Guard and the Marines in terms of enforcing order in these situations. But then also the protesters that are obviously there for a cause. Some of them, a bit more hell-bent on things such as violence and even instigation. And that's where, obviously, it becomes incredibly challenging for journalists in those environments. So, you know, whether this incident with the Australian journalist is a one-and-done case, I don't think it is. But obviously, it got a lot of engagement as a result.
Has the implementation of a curfew made a difference to the protests? And what is the mood like in LA now?
Well, yes, the LA mayor recently implemented a no assembly zone in downtown Los Angeles, where some of the initial protests began. There's also been the mobilization of the National Guard, and also the Marines have been coordinating with Los Angeles police around best places to mobilize and allocate resources to ensure that public disorder remains at a minimum. And so at the moment, it seems that Los Angeles is trying to obviously readjust and come to terms with the extent of the protests which have taken place. But backlash and tension continues, especially in the immigrant community and adjacent, but then also American, first-generation American communities, which are coming to terms with the implications of Trump's actions on their people, their ability to stay and live safely and be protected in the United States, but then also what the presence of, you know, military and you know, state suppression assets being utilized in their local cities means for their ability and right to protest. And so that's been a big ongoing discussion and something that I'm sure is being reflected amongst the protesters. In terms of what's happening in LA at the moment, protests and violence have not, been observed in levels that were witnessed earlier this week. But there are still protests in some pockets, and that's been an area where the National Guard and the LAPD and now the Marines are trying to control the ongoing disorder. And so, yeah, I'm guessing that, and I'm projecting that probably by the end of this week that protest will probably die down significantly or become mainly non-violent. And that's been the overarching theme for the majority of these protests. They've been relatively non-violent. But one area where the LAPD, the LA Police Department, is focusing their resources is on criminal disorder and criminal offences involved with these protests. And that's been with things such as, you know, damage of property, violence and instigation of police officers and obviously the National Guard, etc. And so that's obviously been one area that Newsom has been very vocal about, and also one place where I've seen the media has been covering as well.
Could these protests continue to spread even beyond LA?
Well, that's something we've already seen throughout this week is a national distribution and spread of the protests which have taken place in Los Angeles. There's a real national concern for what Trump's actions mean for immigrant communities in the United States. And those concerns are echoed in cities across the United States because they're all diverse areas of the country and very reflective of the tapestry of immigrant communities and cultures, and even migrant communities that live and call the United States home. And Trump's immigration orders have been a real threat and a jarring threat to the existential presence of these communities in the US. And so we've seen protests in Chicago, in New York City, and even in cities in the South as well, where they're not necessarily termed sanctuary cities. Unlike areas in Los Angeles, those protests have been largely peaceful. Obviously, in cities like New York, there was an assembly outside Trump Tower, a few dozen people were arrested, and there's been protests in Chicago as well. And so whether we're going to continue to see protests against these immigration orders, I'd say absolutely. I'd say in the summer, I mean, it is the summer in the United States at the moment. As the summer months continue, I think that protests and assembly will absolutely continue. And these are very important discussions which are being had and are very consequential for millions of people in the United States, quite literally. And so, you know, I'm sure this will be also a thing that will inevitably continue into Trump's term as well. We're only 5 months in now, so we'll just have to wait and see what follows as well.
That was Andre Fau, also from the Yale Daily News, on the ongoing anti-ICE protests in Los Angeles.
International Desk on 95BFM.
I don't kiss men.
The Wire.
But I kissed him.
Trump's response to the LA protests has been a critical point this week for US politics as the public onlooks the face-off of protesters against Trump's immigration policies and his excessive military backlash. US-trained legal academic Auckland University Associate Professor Scott Optican says the move threatens core rule of law and use of force principles that have guided past American presidents, saying this purposeful escalation allows him to employ anti-immigrant rhetoric to stoke fear and galvanize his political base. University of Auckland's Political and International Relations Associate Professor Maria Armudian also said it's yet more evidence of Trump's unchecked power and the country's apparent slide into authoritarianism. I spoke with Scott Optican about the implications of Trump's response to these protests and the discourse around immigration. To start, I asked him to explain how Trump's use of force threatens the principle of appropriate use of force and the rule of law.
Right. So the governor of California has actually filed a lawsuit against the use of both National Guard troops and Marine troops. And that case is going to be heard in court tomorrow in the United States. So what happened was, is you've got people who are on the streets of L.A. protesting raids by ICE agents, immigration agents. And the, you know, this is a big flashpoint in the United States ever since Trump's election. Much of the protest was lawful. Some of it got violent. And so in response to that, and largely an overreaction to that, Trump called up and federalized 2,000 National Guard troops. Now, National Guard troops are actually troops that are controlled by state governors. They are people that have ordinary jobs, and they're reservists, and then they can be called up to help keep peace and order, provide emergency relief in a state. But they're under state control. But what Trump did is he federalized them. He invoked a statute claiming that there was some type of rebellion going on in Los Angeles, and federalized those National Guard and brought them under his control, and then has deployed them, in Los Angeles in various capacities, although at the moment they're not making arrests or, you know, or doing any kind of real heavy patrolling as they would be in situations of true civil disorder. In addition, he has called up Marines, actual soldiers, you know, the ones who go out into foreign countries and engage in warfare on behalf of the United States. He's called them up. Again, they're not actually on the streets, but they are, you know, it's kind of at the moment, I think they're in front of federal buildings protecting them. And those are actual active duty, you know, troops under federal control. The reason this is problematic is because, number one, U.S. law forbids active deployment of military troops on the streets for law enforcement purposes. That's called the law of posse comitatus. It's a very old law in the United States, and it was designed to make sure that there is a distinction between the use of military force and policing, ordinary policing, and to make sure that military force is not used against civilians. In terms of the National Guard component of this, from my perspective and many other, you know, legal academics, and we'll see what the judge says, Trump was not within his rights to federalize the National Guard, to bypass the governor of California and assume direct control over those troops and deploy them on the streets, because we're not really facing a rebellion, which is what the statute requires. It's not an invasion or rebellion or any kind of insurrection. It's protests, and indeed protests are lawful, but with a lot of protests, sometimes some people get violent. But the police in Los Angeles are well-equipped to handle it, and the mayor of L.A. and the governor of California have made very clear that they think this is a complete overreaction. It's unlawful for Trump to take control of these troops, and worse than that, it has escalated the situation. In other words, it actually has fanned the flames and added fuel to the fire and made things worse. Of course, a lot of people, myself included, thinks that's exactly what Trump wants. Really, he just wants to pick a fight with a blue state governor. He wants to pick a fight with immigrants. He wants to use anti-immigrant rhetoric, and he wants to use the specter and of violence and an exaggeration of the nature and level of violence in order to justify the use of force, which is part of a part of an agenda to gin up his base politically. So there's a lot of political motivations to this, and then there's also just a significant amount of kind of authoritarian tendency part of Trump to use a military force even when it's not warranted. So that's where it's going on. And tomorrow there's going to be a hearing in a court in California in which the governor of California has brought a lawsuit claiming that the use of these troops, both the National Guards and Marines, as a federal matter is unlawful and that the L.A. police are well able to take care of it. I would also like to point out that Trump's order federalizing the National Guard didn't just apply to California. It can be applied in any states. We're starting to see protests break out in other cities and states across the United States. Hopefully, they will stay peaceful. But theoretically, the Guard in those states could be deployed there as well. So it's a very developing situation. And from my point of view, as someone who believes in the rule of law and the separation of civilian and military authority and the separation of federal authority and state authority and the desire to keep policing, you know, within proper bounds, it's all very worrying.
What kind of precedent does this set, and what kind of consequences are these actions likely to have for U.S. leadership or even Trump's presidency alone going forward?
Well, I mean, Trump thinks the consequences for him are good because he you know, his election was largely on the back of anti-immigration rhetoric, right? I mean, this is one of his big issues. You know, he ginned up a lot of false fear about immigrants. A lot of anti-immigration rhetoric, you know, a lot of xenophobic discourse about immigrants, you know, and that was one of the things that got him elected. So as far as he's concerned, you know, engaging in these immigration raids and, you know, putting down protests against them, he thinks it works for him politically. He's happy for the optics. That's what he wants. Consequences for the rule of law are really, really, really significant because it's basically an authoritarian creep in the use of force. And to the extent that, you know, governors, you know, have to capitulate to this or, you know, this becomes kind of the new norm, then it's just one more step towards, you know, a kind of a creeping authoritarianism in the use of federal power, you know, as directed by, you know, by the president. Not to mention, of course, just the people who are caught in the middle, you know, which are the residents of cities. Who are caught up in this, the immigrants themselves, many of whom have lived here for years and years, who pay taxes, who might be undocumented, but they've otherwise done nothing wrong. I mean, Trump originally said that he was going to go after criminal aliens, people who had done, you know, bad things and who were sort of highly eligible for deportation. But what started the trouble in L.A. was actually ICE enforcement and raids on businesses and shops and trying to take into custody people who have really no criminal records and had done anything wrong. So immigration is an issue that really needs to be dealt with in the United States. But the long-term consequences of this, other than these challenges to the rule of law that I've said, is to basically make it impossible to have any kind of rational or civilized discourse about how we deal with undocumented persons in the United States and simply turn it into a fear-mongering exercise, you know, to gin up Trump's political base. So there's a lot of long-term consequences going forward.
Yeah. One of those things that you've kind of talked about is the optics of it all and how this plays out in the public discourse. I was wondering if you think that, or do you think that media spectacle has any significant role, in your opinion, in Trump's demonstration of power in response to these protests or in the likely effects of these events on political discourse around the issue?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's a narrative war going on right now. So Trump, if you hear his statements about this, he's talking about invaders and, you know, rebellions and insurrectionists and, you know, violence and the streets of L.A. are aflame. But the people on the ground in L.A. are basically saying, look, it's effectively one square mile of downtown L.A. where the violence is, and it's under control. And, you know, this typically happens in protests. There are some people, you know, who go too far and who agitate. But there is definitely a war of narrative and a war of optics. There's a huge amount of social media disinformation going on to some extent on both sides, but far more on the right, from the MAGA right. And, you know, the Trump administration is going to pick out any individual acts of violence or whatnot and try to magnify it a thousandfold as a way of justifying their conduct and also as a way of kind of capturing the narrative and the optics of, you know, L.A. aflame. You know, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, gave a nationwide speech yesterday in which he said just the opposite is happening. It's actually the presence of the troops that are inflaming the situation. So they are creating the optics, which they are then using to their advantage. Now, what has to happen on the other side is that the narrative has to be told the other way. You know, you have to take it away from the focus on immigrants and properly put the focus on the misuse of federal power and presidential power. I also think you need to tell the story of the immigrant communities that are being deeply affected and impacted by this. You know, kids, their parents, people who've been here in the United States, you know, for years. They may be undocumented, but they've otherwise paid taxes. They've contributed to the society. And I think you need to tell their stories, too. It's one of the reasons why I think acts of violence, unfortunately, play right into Trump's hands. And if I had any message for the people there, I would encourage them to use the well-worn tactics of nonviolent, legitimate protest, because that's the optics they want. And then to tell the stories of the people who are being affected. But there definitely is a fight and control for both the visuals and the narrative of what's going on there. And we're going to see which one carries the day.
How do you think the international community should be responding to this use of force against protesters in the United States?
I mean, I think the international community should respond to it. You know, I mean, I think there are various leaders, you know, in South American, Central American countries and in Mexico who have said you need a more humane response to the problem of undocumented people in the United States. You know, occasionally you've had the Vatican make comments, you know, about a more humane approach to, you know, undocumented persons. And so I think those same people, you know, nationally and internationally, need to speak out against this kind of use of force because, you know, authoritarianism and creeping authoritarianism is a problem in many countries around the world now. And it's not just in the United States. And Gavin Newsom also made the point that if it's happening in California now, you know, it's going to start to happen in other states of the United States as well. This is not just going to be limited to California. So you really do have to stand up to this and nip it in the bud. Unfortunately, a lot of the Republicans are not going to do that for various self-interested ideological and political reasons. So the real question in the United States is who is going to be the opposition to this, who's going to stand up to it, and how effective it's going to be. So that's why tomorrow in court, it's going to be very interesting to see if there can at least be a legal challenge to this. And if a judge may be able to do something about it, but we won't know until that case goes forward.
My final question, I guess, basically in relation to that, are you hopeful for any, or is there any possibility for a resolution that satisfies protesters in relation to the issue of ICE raids and Trump's hardline immigration policies?
Yeah, to be honest, I wish I was more hopeful, but I'm not. I mean, you know, it's perfectly clear that Trump thinks that this is a political winner for him. And I think he is going to continue to engage in these raids. I think he's going to continue to use as much federal power to protect and support them as, you know, the politicians and the courts will let him get away with. So, no, I am not hopeful. I mean, the only thing that might be at some point is there might be a backlash. And you may recall in his first administration when they had this horrible policy of separating, you know, parents from their children who had crossed the border unlawfully. And that did create a huge outcry in the United States. And turned out to be, a real political loser for them. So that's why I think starting to tell the stories of the impact of these raids on, you know, people who've lived in the States for years, contributed to society, paid taxes, you know, to tell their human stories may be something that we, you know, that we really need to do. But in the short term, am I hopeful that he's going to stop? Absolutely not. He won't stop until something stops him, either lawsuits or protests, or governors, or people in his own party saying he's gone too far, or, you know, his supporters saying, you know, he's gone too far. But that's the problem with this kind of creeping authoritarianism. You know, you need effective opposition, but it's unclear at the moment where exactly that's going to come from.
That was University of Auckland Law School Associate Professor Scott Optikin on the political implications and drivers of Trump's use of National Guard and Marine Force against the LA protests.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire. The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts 5395.
Kei te marama, kei te marama. O kupuku orotahi, he tau te te jiropi, te kura pai aro.
Earlier this week, the National Business Review released its annual Rich List, which contains information about who the wealthiest people in Aotearoa are. It found that the wealthiest in Aotearoa are now collectively worth over $100 billion. I spoke to Mike McRoberts, Te Ao Māori editor at the NBR, about the list, including its timing in a cost of living crisis and what it means for Māori. I started by asking what the list is and why it's published.
Well, the Rich List is something that NBR has done for a number of years, and I guess it's a reflection of some of the movers and shakers, if you like, in New Zealand. It's not always about money, but there is a $100 million cut-off point to get onto the list, I think, but there's a lot of stuff around philanthropy and that kind of thing too. So in this year's Rich List, the NBR Rich List, there's 119 Kiwi individuals and families who are on the list, and that includes about a dozen newcomers to the 2025 Rich List. And all up, I think the total valuation of this year's Rich List is something like $102.1 billion, up from about $95 billion last year.
Apart from what you've already outlined, how does this year's list compare to past ones?
I think the fact that we have more billionaires, we have two more billionaires, so I think we have something like 18 billionaires this year, up from 16 last year. The Zuru founders, Nick and Matt Mowbray, are still number one. Their valuation comes in at around $20 billion. I think the thing that's different is the fact that we have so many newcomers. And also this year we've done a women's list as well, who traditionally don't feature in that top echelon, I guess, of our Rich List, but we wanted to profile some of the up-and-coming business leaders. And often they're involved with some family trusts and that kind of thing as well. So it's been wonderful to be able to feature them too.
Is it appropriate for this kind of wealth to be celebrated during a cost of living crisis where many people are struggling due to no fault of their own?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Caden. I guess, and you know, amongst our coverage of the list, we had a really interesting piece with the Green Party, with the Green Party leader, Chloe Swarbrick, you know, who called for a fair tax system, a wealth tax because of it. And so I guess the one thing is within that wealth is a lot of job creations. And as I've talked about, the philanthropy too, where, you know, various Rich Listers are giving back in other ways. But yeah, there's a balance. I'm not sure that I'm probably the right person to work out what their balance is, but I actually spent a bit of time with Peter Cooper, who is a billionaire. I think he's worth about $1.6 billion. He's the property developer who revamped and revitalised Britomart. He's also got a property up in the Bove Islands called The Landing. He spends most of his time in California, but he's also Māori. And so to see and hear his story and the way he goes about business, I think is quite inspiring. The use of manaakitanga, kotahitanga, katiakitanga, all of those things, I felt was a really good story to tell and one that might be inspiring to other Māori businesses.
This feeds really well into my next question, which is, in Aotearoa, we know there's a significant wealth gap between Māori and Pākehā. Is this reflected in the rich list?
Yes, it is. But also we don't include on the rich list because it's we tend to look at individuals, not trusts. So if you think of some of the big entities like Ngāi Tahu and Waikato Tainui, who are just doing amazing work. Waikato Tainui, obviously, just a month ago, signing a $1 billion deal with Brookfields to develop Ruakura. They don't feature on this because they're an organisation or a trust as such, an entity. But what we have seen, and that's my job at NBR as Te Ao Māori editor, to report on the Māori economy, is a real growth in the number of Māori entrepreneurs. So people going out on their own in businesses, and they tend to be in quite diverse areas too, Māori tech. Really interesting and diverse pathways that they're taking. And so hopefully we will see that spring up in the future and they become more influential in their leadership.
What has the broad public response been to the rich list being published?
I think it's kind of one of those things where, people probably roll their eyes a little bit. We're a business publication. We are subscriber-based only, so we don't have advertising or government funding. So for our subscribers, they love it. I mean, we've had an increase in subscriptions since the list was released on Monday. But I think for the general public, there's some stuff they can take out of it. As I said, talked about the newcomers and maybe the direction that some of the businesses in New Zealand are going in and where opportunities may be. I think, we need to have a strong business community. The Prime Minister keeps talking about, growth, but that's got to come from somewhere. And whether it's, with our agricultural sector, a few days on this week, or our business community, it's all about those opportunities and growing those opportunities.
Can you speak a bit more about what that political response has been?
The political response to the list?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as I mentioned, Chloe Swarbrick saw it as a great opportunity to say that we should have a wealth tax. The Prime Minister was asked whether New Zealand having 18 billionaires and rich lists is collectively worth more than 100 billion was a good thing or a bad thing. He thought of it was fantastic that we've got people with ambition and aspiration. So it's the political reaction has gone much the way you'd expect the political reaction to go, I suppose.
That was the National Business Review Te Ao Māori editor Mike McRoberts on their recently published Rich List. The Rich List can be viewed on the NBR website if you have a subscription, which is free for students.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The University of Auckland's Scott Optican, Councillor Shane Henderson, Yale Daily News Andre Fa'aoso, Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cepoloni, and the National Business Review's Mike McRoberts. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.